You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport podcast on The Athletic. Matt Slater back with us this week after a week away. And our guest is John Herdman, the English coach looking to transform Canadian football into a force both on and off the pitch, all the way from grassroots to elite level, ahead of Canada being one of three nations co-hosting the Men's World Cup in 2026. John is a former primary school teacher in England, was an academy coach at Sunderland, and has already led Canada's hugely popular women's team to Olympic medals and a World Cup quarterfinal. He's now in charge of the Canada men's team, who are bidding to qualify for a Men's World Cup in Qatar next year for the first time since 1986. John, thank you very much for joining us. I've given a brief resume of your career. Just explain your pathway into coaching, first of all.
Yeah, the pathway into coaching, you know, started with most young men who dream of being a footballer playing for Newcastle United, but that didn't transpire. Being told you weren't good enough at 15, 16 pushed us in a new pathway, which seems to be the obvious one, which is into coaching. And started coaching at 16, picked up my first my first FA coaching badge at 17, and then that sort of catapulted us into a teaching pathway through university. And then on the back of that, started my own business as a franchise holder with Brazilian soccer schools up in the Northeast. That took us into an opportunity to do some lecturing and, you know, from that, professional academies. And that's where, you know, I dreamed of being, you know, working at the highest level with young, up-and-coming professional players. So that was at Sunderland Football Club and at Hartlepool United Centre of Excellence. I knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life.
It's interesting that everything starts with teaching, though, because talk to a lot of people in this industry, the most successful coaches do seem to have had some kind of teaching background.
Yeah, when you're in the coaching industry, there's an absolute it's like a drug, this ability to see people grow, develop, get better, improve. And I think the teaching pathway is the foundation to really understanding the craft to get the best out of people. I think that's a major part of the foundation I've relied upon, like understanding pedagogy and I guess the science of learning, and then being able to apply that to a football field. You could sense that in the time that I was in the academy environments, a lot of the coaches had transitioned straight from playing backgrounds. And, you know, when you were able to bring in teaching tools and create learning environments for players, you could see that they were interested in you. At first, a lot of coaches would stand off and they'd call you an academic and all that stuff. And, you know, what do you know about football? You've never played.
Did you have that a lot?
Oh, without a doubt. Early doors, it was really interesting, my time at Sunderland. I remember speaking up in one of the academy meetings, and I'd done a sports science degree and I was lecturing in sports science at the time. And we had our meeting and the academy director was there, and I remember speaking up on a matter of nutrition with the players. And as soon as I'd finished my sentence, someone piped up and said, "Can someone translate what he's just said?" And it was that type of culture, right? It was that they just made sure you knew your place. And I'll never forget John Tiganaut just taking over Fulham, and a colleague in the in the lecturing business had invited us down to Fulham. He was working there and he just said, look, this guy's light years ahead of what we've seen in England. So I spent a week watching what he was doing. I came back to Sunderland and the academy director at the time, I remember I plucked up the courage to stand next to him on the side of the pitch and say, hey, Ian, I just spent some time down in Fulham. I mean, would you like us to do a presentation to the guys on, you know, what I've seen? There's some really remarkable stuff. And I'll never forget, he slapped us across the back of the head because I'm only little. And he gave us a whack and he said, son, let us tell you something. There's nothing new in football. It was brilliant. So you just knew. You knew you were battling, absolutely battling. And when I finally left the academy, I sat down with the academy director and I said, look, I'm leaving to head to New Zealand. And I'll never forget, he said, you were way too intelligent for this job. He says, I'm pleased you're leaving because you're going on to bigger and better things. That's what he said. It was brilliant.
Wow. So, I mean, there are so many things to unpick within that answer. But I think it's really interesting at the start that you actually had to take yourself out of English men's football to hone your craft and be accepted.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think getting out of England was the best thing I could have done. It was moving into New Zealand. I mean, their coaching structures were miles ahead of what I'd seen in the UK. And it was reflected in the return on their investment in their Olympic programs. I mean, their medals per GMP were way beyond anything that anyone else was producing around the world. So they were doing something well there. And after living there for 10 years, you really realize how they were able to create a coaching community, which I think some countries took some of their ideas as time went on. But I was fortunate enough to, one, organically be put in an environment where these regional sports trusts, they put all of the sports people together in one office. I was the football development director. But on the left, you had Pat Barwick, who was an Olympic medalist coach. On the right, I had Lester Routledge, ex-All Black, who had just come back from Italy. He was the Italian national team coach. Over the way was an Australian rules football ex-coach. And this cross-pollination that was happening on a daily basis was really, for me, the foundation of where you got to understand that coaching is way more than the X's and O's. And the opportunity these other sports are providing, like a lot of the innovations right on the edge of where these sports cross. That's what New Zealand afforded my development. And yeah, it was by chance I moved out there, but ultimately the design and the coaching success has been in that fertile environment.
John, I wonder if we could then sort of move the story on from New Zealand to Canada, which I suppose is like the second big move, I guess. And then perhaps you can start to sort of lead us into your third big move, which was from women's to men's.
Yeah. Well, that third big move was a big oh shit moment. I mean, that was a big moment. The second move was a big shift because in New Zealand, we just launched the whole of football plan and I was spearheading that. What I seen with Canada is just this sleeping giant. You know, when we played them in New Zealand, they were 3-0 up in 20 minutes. And I remember they came out with the Adidas kit on and it just looked so professional. And they were telling us about residency programs and players were getting paid. And you were like, wow, you know, this is a pretty formidable program. But they hadn't produced any results that really spoke to them being a women's football nation. So moving across to Canada was an opportunity genuinely to get into full-time high-performance coaching, but at the same time to build a program and keep that program management role where you looked after the talent system. So it really fitted my skill set at the time. And it was the best thing I've ever done. Again, like moving to New Zealand was cool, but moving to Canada was next level because whenever you go into an Olympic program, you're supported by the Olympic committees and Olympic funding. So you're guaranteed funding for a certain period of time, which is a quadrennial. So you can plan over 4 years with real diligence and detail. You can map out a four-year journey from sort of one cycle, one medal to the next podium. And that's what I loved about Canada. There was guaranteed funding that allowed you to be innovative in a country that has massive participation rates. And when we won that first medal, the country took off. We really managed to get the country behind football. And the crazy thing is, like many people seen, the move into the men's game is a demotion, because the reality is the women's game, they'd sell out crowds within, and our US game sold out within 2 hours. The men's team were averaging 10,000 a game. There's a lot of apathy on that men's side because they just haven't been competitive since the last World Cup, 1986. They won a Gold Cup in 2000, but it always seems to be one step forward, two steps back on the men's side. So that shift across, like, regardless of how it all unfolded, the leaks into the press and then the misogyny, you know, in the media and social media, to, you know, people just waiting for you to trip up, to say it was the worst decision, a failed experiment. You know, it's been a hell of a journey, I'll tell you that. This last 4 years has been a great ride in terms of experiencing that shift from, you know, being a successful women's coach to now on the verge of being a successful men's coach in the international arena.
You are, I think, still the only person that has gone from women's to men's in the same country?
Yeah, I think there might have been a shift since, but it was the first. At the time, the recognition was we were on the cusp of landing the 2026 World Cup. And the program needed a complete overhaul. That was the reality. And it was like a perfect storm. An opportunity came to, you know, coach a major national team that would have all of the funding you need and allow you to take their team to the next level. And it coincided with some questions around the men's national team program and the coaching and all the technical leadership. And, you know, the decision was made to transfer me across to the men's side, which in my mind, if we qualify for 2022, would ensure that FIFA windfall of around $15 million, which is what we've never had in our coffers. And then from the next stage of this, you'd be into 2026 with another guaranteed windfall, which is what would set the grassroots, the women's, the men's up forever. And there's something about making 2022, which creates a foundation for 2026. That was the motivator for me. Like, I was excited to take this other job, and I'd done 7 years in Canada. I couldn't see how I was going to take the women's program too much further forward. And yeah, you might have got to a silver or a gold medal, but it still wouldn't have shifted the program any further forward. Your $4 million from the government would have just kept turning around. So the men's team was just one of those challenges, huge challenge. And it's been amazing.
Well, you've already mentioned the fact that it's one World Cup, 86. I know there was the success in 2000 at the Gold Cup. Only the US and Mexico and Canada have won a Gold Cup. So that's a significant achievement in your region. But I think in July 2017, Canada were ranked 94th by FIFA. I'm not sure what it was, because you took the job in January 2018, right? Was it around that early?
That's right, yeah.
I think you were probably about in the 80s. I think it was moving in the right direction, but you know, you're still way back there. I think it was 78 was the ranking coming out of 2018. You're now down to 48. You know, so you've that's a pretty significant move. And you're top 50. You've got Mexico, US ahead of you, and Costa Rica marginally ahead of you still. Mm-hmm. But that's some achievement.
It's been some big steps. I mean, you'd like to take credit for those steps forward. I mean, everything's coincided with it being the right time. And I think with your player pools, I mean, I had Christine Sinclair to work with. And then on the men's side, you know, when I took over, I had a precocious 17-year-old Alfonso Davies. 16 he was, 16. And then a 17-year-old Jonathan David. Any opportunity I could give a Liam Miller at the time at Liverpool, who was 17. You know, I took a lot of heat from that internally, from the veterans who didn't feel these young players had earned, you know, the rights to these matches. But, you know, at the time, I was very clear that there need to be a radical shift in how we went about things. And I knew we had to make this team younger. We had to give opportunities to these young men. And you know, prime example, Johnny David goes into that Gold Cup and he becomes the young player of the tournament and, you know, gets the golden boot. And then the next thing, he's off to Lille, you know, getting a big transfer, a big move. People are talking about him. And the same thing's just happened with Tejon Buchanan. You know, he's just a young lad who we give a big opportunity to in the Gold Cup. And he grabbed it. Again, he becomes the young player of the tournament and gets a big move to Europe in Belgium. So these are the things that have become important. It was, you know, strategically, we were very clear that one of our strategies was to identify young players, use the national team to springboard to accelerate their career. And I think that's, you know, without belittling the shirt, it's a key step. It's an important step for Canada, because I think this country has got a lot of talent that the national team has to support, and we're starting to see that. So I think our player pool is definitely played into this, and some strategies to ensure that these young players are given a platform to be seen in Europe and to build the brand of Canada in European environments. And Alfonso Davies, what he's achieved at Bayern Munich is just made Canada a shining light now for countries around the world in terms of their scouting and how clubs and leagues are looking at our national team.
Just go back to because this is a two-part question, but the first part, going back to the decision was made to move you across from women's to men's. How much say did you have in that then?
Absolute say. So the conversation went a little bit like this. It was November 2018. I knew that there were some challenges on the men's side with the technical direction. I had a big offer to move back home and be part of a project that was so exciting for me personally, and a chance to bring my family back home. And it went with the president, the vice president, the general secretary. What's it going to, you know, take to keep you here? Look, want to live in Canada, enjoy in Canada. But the only thing that is relevant at this point, because the women's team can't move forward, you don't have $10 million to invest into the program. The only thing I can do in this country is help take the men's team forward. It's the only thing I can do to help this country move forward. And I understand what's missing, because I'd had a chance to listen to some of the people in the men's game, and you could sense it was disconnected, that their purpose would always give way to pain, the pain of traveling in CONCACAF. It was a team that just needed a real strategic mindset and direction. That's how the conversation went. And they looked across the table, they all smiled and said, okay, let's make this happen.
And then that's the second part, really, which from everything that you're talking about, the attraction of this job is not simply coaching a squad of 23 men to get to a World Cup. The attraction of this job is the system within which you are operating, and the opportunity to change that system.
Absolutely. Like, who really wants to go to Qatar for a World Cup? Like, seriously, it's not something that's on my bucket list, for sure. What's on my bucket list is the ability to really set this country up for the home World Cup in 2026. You know, for this group of men, it was pretty clear. You know, we will be the last group of men that earned the right to play at a World Cup. And that's what they're striving and fighting for. This country since 1986 has never been connected or united behind football. And I've seen it on the women's side, like the power of what that women's team was able to do to the country, just the inspiration, the hope, you know, getting people out of their daily wars and strifes. You know, it just has you've just experienced it with England on the Euros. You know what it does for a country. But you picture Canada, when the World Cup's on, and I hosted the World Cup in 2014. I was on one of the key hosts for Canada's TV show. We had like 8-10 million people watch us. And the thing I remember was just how Canada becomes compartmentalized with little Italy, little Serbia, little Portugal, little England. And nobody for 30 odd years has ever had the chance to pull on that red shirt and become Canada. And it's part of the fabric here. Like this country is so disconnected in its football communities. There's a lot of infighting across the different, you know, migrants that have come across and taken their control on football. It's really interesting to understand that you're a football nation, or you're becoming a football nation for the first time in a long time. This is the power in this group of men's hands. You know, this is what we're fighting for. It's just way deeper than let's get to Qatar and tick that off on everyone's sort of bucket list. This is changing a country forever and laying a foundation for 2026 where we can be genuinely competitive. Because if we don't qualify for 22, you'll only participate in 26. And then you'll give all of those people, the hockey communities, the chance to say Canada sucks again. And that's what we're fighting for.
From discussions with other national men's team coaches that you may have had, is your role unique? I mean, I can't imagine. I don't know. Let me pick Roberto Martinez at Belgium. He's probably not operating within the same, I was going to say constraints, but he's not operating within the same system that you are, is he?
No, it is. It's different. The role that I took on, and this was, you know, clear from the board of directors, they wanted me to transplant a lot of the high performance processes and systems on the women's side to the men's. What you're talking about here is like 15 years of international tournament experience where you've brought in experts like Dr. Kerry Evans, who helped the All Blacks deliver, you know, two World Cups. You know, he worked with our team, London 2012, and helped us build some of the mental performance elements to our high performance system. So it's about transplanting and transferring a lot of those, we would just call it organizational knowledge, shifting it across to the men's side. And that's what had been missing. It was systems, structures, a high performance culture had been missing, clarity in quadrennial planning, like building a plan out to 2022 that enveloped the youth development system as well. So, you know, part of my role is I'd be on the grass. I've been on the grass with my coaches, my assistant coaches, with all of the U15 academy kids in this country. We had an MLS integration system. Nowhere else in the world would you see a national team, a national program, go into an academy. So say Manchester United, we would walk into Toronto FC, Montreal, Vancouver Whitecaps, and we take over their academy for nearly 2 weeks. So our staff come in, we work with every age group, 15 to 19s, U15s, on the grass, in meetings, and they get a feel for Canada. We infuse them with this passion for playing for Canada. We expose them to our identity, our way of playing. More importantly, we help them fall in love with our program so that when they get asked to go to Portugal or Italy, because the majority of them have dual passports, they want to stay with us. They have a feel that they know who we are, that we're interested, that we care. these are things that we've done, but certainly these last 14 games and the World Cup qualification have moved someone into an acting program director role. So I can just focus on these matches, because it became very clear through the Gold Cup that your attention's getting pulled in too many places. And I need to focus now on getting this team through.
The academy stuff's really interesting, though, because whilst that has been a problem for Canada, that will be an increasing issue for the majority of nations. I mean, England have it an awful lot. In this world now where people move borders, families change countries, children are born in different countries, obviously, so many people are going to be, men and women, will be eligible for more than one country. So actually, at international level, John, you are having to compete to attract those 14, 15-year-olds in the same way big clubs are trying to attract 14, 15-year-olds.
That is the reality in Canada. I mean, it's greatest strength, greatest weakness. You know, the greatest strength is we have this sort of non-linear dynamic system where players just appear in Canada. Jonathan David, Tejon Buchanan, you know, Ayo Akinola recently, you know, they appear in Canada because it's a great country to come and live. Its doors are open. But the challenge is they then dream of playing for maybe their home nation. In the past, again, like, we just hadn't done a strong enough job of creating a professional, high-performing image of our national teams. And when your national team isn't competitive, you haven't got a leg to stand on. So we've had to shift what we do on the grass and make sure that these players are excited to come and play for Canada, but more importantly, at the youth level, show some love, actually show that the national coach is willing to go and get on the grass with a 15-year-old and have those interactions with them. It's been important. I mean, what you'll see traditionally is you'll get a national coach, they go and have a cup of coffee, they'll take a Starbucks, they'll stand on the side of the pitch, they'll drink their coffee, watch a game, talk anesthetically to the coaching staff and then leave. We just said we got to change that culture. Like, if you want people to care about you, you've got to show you care about them. The one way you care is getting on the grass with them and knowing their names. And I think that's been a big shift in our country.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Many of our listeners won't know a huge amount about Canadian sport, let alone Canadian football. There are a few clues. I mean, there was a great line about the hockey guys would say soccer sucks, you know, if you failed again. Can you just say, to people that don't get the challenge that you guys, that you have faced, what does Canada look like as a sporting nation? We know that ice hockey is the big sport, right? How much talent does it hoover up? How hard is it for any other sport to get seen and heard?
Football in this country is seen as an initiator sport. It's an initiator from the age of around 5 to 12 for hockey. It's a foundation sport for hockey. When we look at that as our starting point, we know that Alphonso Davies is a game changer for us. For him, being on social media, meeting Drake and, you know, all of those things that are going on, it's huge. It's absolutely huge to change the narrative of this new generation of people. And there's a staunch market for hockey in this country that is slowly going to change. And it needs two World Cup cycles for Canada to change that. That's what we've been missing, the two World Cup cycles that makes that change. And I experienced it in New Zealand, the 2010 All Whites. You know, they qualified for the World Cup for the first time. And, you know, you've got the All Blacks and the New Zealand team are called the All Whites. And literally the country stopped and it was an all white country in terms of the shirts. Like the country got behind it, but they couldn't back up in 2014 or 2018. And when you miss those opportunities, it's just like one of those, you know, Christmas comes and then it's gone and it's just too long again for that country to really cement a foundation. That's why I'm putting so much emphasis on 2022. Like it's important for us to get the double cycle. And we have generationally got a group of players that can move the needle, not only in their results, but their personalities. They can shift it because they're speaking. They're so young. They're speaking to that next generation. You know, that 15, 16, 17-year-old that are going to become adults and fans of and start putting their money in recreation time into something different. But in terms of the country, what you have for football, Match of the Day, Sky Sports, all of the things that are happening daily, that's hockey here.
It's just really interesting that you've gone to two countries and you've had success in two countries where the dominant team sport is something else that just absolutely not only hoovers up the talent, but almost defines that country as a sporting nation. And that's interesting. I don't know. I mean, did you do that on purpose, John? Was that just the way it's gone?
I think the shift to Canada, and this was, I remember being in the interviews and it was clear, like the whole structure of Canada was very similar to New Zealand. It had a very diverse and migrant population. It had a dominant sporting culture, but you could sense that football is just bubbling in that country. It's just ready to break through. And the national team, you know, is the key to it. The 2010 New Zealand All Whites was to experience that when a country breaks through for the first time in a quarter of a century, you know that the power, and it's then having the strategic ability to do it again. That's the piece that we just never got right in New Zealand. So I know what's coming. It's going to be a watershed, groundbreaking moment when this team, you know, put themselves into a World Cup. And I remember in my first interviews, you know, I said, look, we'll qualify for 2022. And people just laughed and, you know, this guy's a joke and you can't believe he's just put his neck in a noose and all of this stuff. But we had to say it at the front end. And for me to go out there and say, look, I don't care if I get fired. I'm going to die trying on this one. Like the inevitable will happen, but let's go out on your shield, if that makes sense, and just see if you can shift the psychology of a country that hasn't had any right to believe that this is going to happen. It's starting to shift.
There's one other thing. There's one other place that we haven't talked about. I don't think you've mentioned, I don't think anyone's mentioned it yet. And this surely would move the needle, right? Canada's relationship with its neighbor.
US.
Victories over them. That'll do it, won't it?
So on the women's side, they were like my nemesis, eh? After the 2012 Olympic game, that really sort of stoked the fire. And it is, it's that rivalry. It's the England-Scotland. That's probably the way I can It is. It feels like an England Scotland, but we're Scotland, if that makes sense. And they are the big brothers, sisters to the south. And you know, this is a derby reality in the minds of players and fans. And the best way to win fans over is to beat the US. It's that simple. And we did it. We did it in the Nations League for the first time in 36 years. We beat them 2-0 at home, but we didn't just beat them. We put on a performance where people shifted, their mentality shifted. And I think that was a huge turning point for this program. We had about 20,000 people in Toronto watch that match. And a lot of people were just in disbelief walking out the stadium to have seen a Canadian team on the front foot pressing the US from the first to the last minute. And doing well, like playing at times for long periods better than them. And they had their Pulisic's, their Zach Steffens, their Weston McKennie's. It wasn't some ordinary US team that had rocked up. It was a big moment for us. And then Nations World Cup qualifying, we've just gone down to their place and picked up a point on the road. It's changing. The narrative's changing. And even just building a relationship now with the coach of the team, there's a respect there that's starting to form, I think, between the countries. And I think we've left a mark on these teams, on US, Mexico. We're in their minds now. There's a little bit of dread having to play Canada, which just wasn't there in the past. Again, I can thank people like Alfonso Davies and Jonathan David and Kyle Aaron. You know, those players have given us that X factor, but we've shifted a mentality within the group that we'll impose ourselves on these teams, home or away. And I think that's what they're dreading more than anything.
Let's finish a little bit how we started with, by talking about the coaching industry or the business of coaching. You talked about misogynistic comments when you move from the women's game to the men's game. Is that because people within the men's game didn't think someone who'd coached in women's team sport could come into the male environment? Is that what they were saying to you?
Yeah, pretty much. I think the general theme was, I think there was a shock and disbelief. You know, wow, this actually happened. For a lot of people, it was, wow, this is a great decision. Finally, we'll get a chance for our men's team to push on. And for others, it was the diehard sort of football community, people who've been in the fabric of the sport. And I think it was such a break from pattern thinking in the minds of people. There was an emotional reaction to that, which was, how is he going to manage the egos of a dressing room? Well, women have egos. Women are competitive. Women get upset when they lose. Women get upset when they're on the bench. I mean, it absolutely blew my mind, the sort of mentality that you're going to have a different dynamic in the dressing room. What I learned, you know, there is differences. There's no doubt that there are differences in the male and female psyche and the way they connect and bind in cultures. It is a bit different, but leadership is consistent. High performance is consistent. The foundations of high performance is consistent. I was surprised and shocked that people couldn't get around their minds that so much of what you do is as a coach is functional. There are rules and there's systems and processes that produce performance. You know, we followed our well-trodden path in the men's, and there's been some adaptations.
It's very odd, isn't it, John? Because I think about this an awful lot. And if a male tennis coach coached a female tennis player and then switched to a male tennis player, I don't think there'd be any comment about it. Yet Andy Murray, a few years back, brought in Amélie Mauresmo as his coach, a female coach, and there was loads of comment about it. And sometimes there's one rule on one side and one rule on the other. The comments that you got when you switched are only, I would imagine, a small proportion of what you would have got had you been a female coach who had coached the Canadian women's team and moved to the Canadian men's team.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is ridiculous when you when you have explained high performance is high performance. Yes, there are differences in how male individuals within a team sport or female individuals within a team sport connect. From your experience, there are differences, but high performance is high performance.
What was interesting is there hadn't been any females working on the men's side. So quickly, I injected four females into the staff immediately, you know, from the mental performance trainer to the head of medical, therapist and administrator. You know, straight away, these men needed to understand there's a completely different dynamic when you bring a mix of gender. It is very powerful. That was the starting point. And I remember making sure there was a photograph of our national anthem where these women were prevalent in that to send a message out to the country. Things are changing. Within that as well, I mean, a great example was the second camp I had, there was another fight. So I really went after the leadership group on the training field, in the training environment. I shut the training down. I took the leaders to one side and went after them and really went in at them hard. And it was, look, very clearly, this is a effing dysfunctional team. This team is so dysfunctional. If you just put a helicopter on what's just happened there, the Scottish lads went in that direction. The Spanish-speaking guys went that way. Another group went this way. The Eastern Europeans went that way. I said, this is your team. This is Canada. This is a microcosm of everything that's wrong with this team. The culture and why you guys have won absolutely FA in the last 30 years. If you don't fix this, nothing changes. We got to get to the core of this. And the captain, funny enough, it was a Scottish lad, that the captain at the time, he came to see us. He said, look, Gaffer, the guys have been talking. He says, and we're not really happy about what you said out on the field. He said, you know, this is men's football. These things happen. It's part of the culture. It's part of what happens in men's football. I said, hey, don't make this a gender issue. Come on. Don't make this a gender issue. The issue is you're not willing to accept that this team is dysfunctional. And at the heart of this, you're a leader. And the leadership is underperforming. And we need higher levels of leadership. And you've got to invest in the leadership of this group to connect it. This is a team without a clear purpose. And we got to fix that. All of my interviews prior with the group, I interviewed 40 guys before I actually met them. I interviewed past players, coaches, and everything came out that in big moments, this team couldn't connect and bind in big moments. It fell apart in big moments. And there they were in the training session. As soon as their friction was there, they fell apart.
Isn't it weird though, John? Isn't it weird that this is men's football? Because that can be the environment on so many different levels. If you are perceived, I think, as an outsider who hasn't played men's football or maybe coached in men's elite football, this is what we're saying, that will always be thrown back, won't it? This is men's football, or this is elite football, or this isn't school football. Coaches who haven't played elite men's football or professional men's football will probably get something like that thrown back at them. Do you think that this is changing? Do you think there is hope for, you know, people who are studying, who are doing degrees, who are in classrooms, who are women, to forge a coaching career in elite men's sport? Is the future more hopeful than maybe what you had to put up with being clipped around the head at an academy in the Northeast?
People like Mourinho, Benitez, they started to pave the way in the 2000s. If I'd stayed in England, I probably would have progressed a couple of years later. You know, when those coaches, Wengers, you know, guys that weren't seen as having real strong playing backgrounds started to change the narrative. But I think what we're talking about now is breaking like new boundaries. I think the game has become more open-minded. Like, if anything, the English FA are leading. in so many areas. When you look at their high performance research and how they bring teams together, you know, they are well ahead of the curve in my mind now. But I still think there's a lot more barriers and boundaries that are going to be broken in time. It's going to take time to see your first female high profile coach will be a big step. You know, Jill Ellis, after the US game results was knocking on the door. You know, I think she was close. I think Hope Powell, to be fair, was very close in 2012. I thought she would have made the breakthrough. Knowing Hope as well, she has the personality to really be at that level and at the forefront. But no one had the courage at the time to make that decision. So again, like I say, I'm one of those social experiments. If we don't qualify for the World Cup, we've broken record upon record. We've done things with this team that have never been done. But people are still waiting for the moment to say, we told you. We told you. It doesn't matter. You can go. We've just gone to the Azteca, outperformed Mexico in the Azteca, right? And qualitatively, on paper, you could argue their team's still better than Canada's, but we've just outperformed them in our XG. The facts tell you we were a better team on the night in the Azteca. No one's done that before.
If you do qualify for the World Cup, you know how it works. You'll get linked with jobs back in this country. I sense at the end of this hour that we've had with you, that wouldn't really, just a standard. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, by the way. This isn't a plea, come and get me plea to clubs in the Football League or whatever. But I sense it needs to be more of a challenge than just that for you, doesn't it? And given everything you've said about 2026 and everything that's in place in the system that you work within, it has to be more than just a 3 points on a Saturday job.
Yeah, it's bigger than that, eh? And it always has been. Like, yeah, you take on the psychology of the city, you take on the psychology of the country that you would go into. It might be greatest strength, greatest weakness. You don't know until you're in those situations. But all I know is that the passion comes from doing something greater than yourself, eh? Greater than your career, greater than any accolades that you could pick up, and having won medals and awards, they're just hollow. It's the sense that you were able to do something for people. You know, you're able to put it down better than you found it. It's just, and these are all cliches, but again, right at the core of what drives us is I get the chance to work with a group of great people to change a country forever. That wouldn't change. That was the same in New Zealand. It was the same when I worked at Southland Soccer, you know, in the deep part of New Zealand and Invercargill. You know, it was to really try and transform that local football community, to switch them on to football. Yeah, and it's been what drives us, you know, that deep passion to do something that is for everyone and is remembered.
It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for giving us your time. And despite all the travels and where you've lived, the accent's as strong as ever. So well done. You haven't picked up any North American twang, have you?
I get hammered when I come home. I get absolutely hammered. Posh Geordie and all that crap.
That's it. Thanks to all our guests. Don't forget, if you're not a subscriber to The Athletic, then head to theathletic.com/footballpod. For a 33% discount off the price of an annual subscription. And I'll see you Monday for the Athletic Football Podcast. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.